I don't have slides this morning. It didn't come together quite well, so I don't have slides. But as you know, we've been working through the gospel account of John, and we are at the end. We are at the last chapter, chapter 21. And there's different theories as to how this chapter came about. And so what I'm going to kind of base what I'm going to talk about on is just one of those theories. The Apostle John, he was nearing the end of his life. He was in Ephesus, part of the church there. It was a church that he had become very fond of. And now he sat in his little cot upstairs apartment overlooking part of the city of Ephesus. Even though he could see out the windows quite well, his eyesight was failing. He couldn't see well anymore, not even well enough to really write. His health was rapidly failing. It's been a year since he had finished his gospel account. He had had different scribes make copies of his gospel account, what he had written. He had sent it off to different churches of Asia Minor and also into Rome. He was hearing reports, though, back that kind of disturbed him. He was hearing how many of the Christian believers were wondering, where was Jesus? Where was Jesus? Wasn't Jesus supposed to return before John's death? Now they're hearing that John, the last of the apostles, is about to die. And so where was Jesus? He could sense anxieties. He could sense worries in the tone of the reports. The believers were questioning, did they get the right message? Did they hear correctly? Did the apostles hear correctly? Not only that, but sporadic local persecutions in different parts of the Roman Empire certainly didn't add to the certainty of life and of living. No one knew for sure what tomorrow might bring. An accusation from a neighbor, a customer, a coworker could easily end their business and perhaps even their life. There were questions. What happens if Jesus doesn't come back before John dies? What happens next? The last of the disciples, the last of the apostles that walked with Jesus is going to be gone. What happens next? Do the Christians then just sit and wait? Do nothing? Or are they supposed to be doing something else while they wait? And so as John hears these things, as John senses that something needs to be done, he gathers together two of his disciples, Polycarp and Ignatius. And as he does so, John's mind goes back decades to a time just after the resurrection of Jesus, a few weeks. John can still see in his mind, his physical sight might be failing, but in his mind's eye, he can still see clearly the events that took place one morning. And so John, with his two disciples, John asks his two disciples to take down the story because it just might answer a few questions and clear up a few things. And that is one theory as to how John chapter 21 came to be. John chapter 21, the common, I suppose, a lot of the sermons and things that you might have heard would involve the miraculous catch of fish by the sea, of Peter's reinstatement, of Peter's public apology for the denials that took place during Jesus' trial. Or perhaps about Peter's future and John's future. Those things are right there in that chapter. But what I want us to kind of listen to, seek out as I go through this chapter again, is to listen to it with kind of the theme of uncertainty as the one that's overriding the whole thing. Some of the questions that might have been asked would be, who is the leader? What should we do? How will we survive? What is going to happen from now on until the end? See, Jesus told his disciples to go to Galilee after the resurrection and wait. That's found in Matthew. And perhaps the disciples were gathered together at or near where the 5,000 were fed a number of years ago. The same place, nearby, but it would bring remembrance back of that event. And so there the disciples are. And John begins. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, which is also known as the Sea of Galilee. And he revealed himself in this way: Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We will go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. So here the disciples are, wondering what to do. Jesus had told them to go there, but no further instructions. What were they supposed to do? I can imagine them kind of sitting around, twiddling their thumbs, maybe working the nets, uncertain. Simon Peter, rises up again as the leader of this group. And the rest of the disciples say, "Well, sounds good to me. We'll follow you. We'll go fishing. We'll go fishing with you." They go out. They go fish all night. They catch nothing. Verse 4 continues, "Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, 'Children, do you have any fish?' They answered him, 'No.'" throughout the gospel accounts, we saw and we discussed how light was one of the themes of John. And I think it's important to note that in verse 4, we see the theme of light coming back once again, just as day was breaking. See, John is trying to portray the darkness, kind of the uncertainty of darkness that they were in. But as Jesus appears on the scene, day begins to break. Yet even though day is breaking and Jesus is on the shore, disciples do not recognize him. And Jesus uses an interesting word to address disciples. Children. Children. Do you have any fish? No, it's a familiar term. It's not like a, hey guys, but more familiar, a family term. Children. And they answered him, no. He said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. I can imagine just the disciples in the boat wondering, what is this crazy guy who's addressing them in a rather unique, untraditional way, who's telling us to, now that the day is breaking, the fish can see the nets, to cast it on the other side. I mean, what's the difference between the left side and the right side? Fish, how could they be on one side and not on the other? But they cast it anyway. And all of a sudden, it's filled. And they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved, and most scholars, most people believe that that means John, the author here. The disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, it is the Lord. And just like in the previous chapter, John is the one who first recognizes Jesus. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. The other disciple came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. Now, can you imagine one of the fishing boats here, unable to bring in the net because there's so much fish in it, that they're just going to have to tow the whole net back to the dock? Well, that's kind of what this picture is here. They weren't able to get all the fish into the boat because that net was so heavy, and so they're just kind of dragging it back. And there's Peter diving off the side. Didn't walk on water this time. He dove in and swam in it. He swims to shore. When they got to land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. I wanted you to take a note of that word, or that little thing, detail, charcoal fire. Because the previous time that word appeared was at Jesus' trial in the court of Caiaphas and Annas. It was where Peter's denial took place. And I'm sure it was quite intentional on John's part to place that little detail there, to draw attention back to the earlier scene. There, it was in the dark. You could hardly see and recognize one another. But this charcoal fire is now in the daylight. Well, everything is out in the open. Not only that, but Jesus himself had prepared breakfast for them. So Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. I can picture John in his mind, that 153 is stuck, is burned into his mind. They counted, double counted, and that number is stuck decades later. And although there were so many, another detail, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. In this little passage here, it's very reminiscent of the feeding of the 5,000, how Jesus took the bread, how Jesus took the fish, broke it, and passed it out. It's also very, it can look back to perhaps the Last Supper, how Jesus took the bread and broke it. I mentioned how in John's Gospel, the Last Supper itself, the communion part, is not, that scene is not present. But the whole idea of communion, of abiding, of sharing, is present through the stories of the feeding of 5,000, and also through this story where Jesus provides breakfast for his disciples. And so here Jesus is doing the same thing he was doing before. He's providing, he's caring, he's serving, he's giving. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Now what did Jesus mean by "more than these"? Did he mean the boat, the nets, the fish? Probably not. Did he mean to ask Peter, do you love me more than these disciples? No, that's probably not what he meant. What Jesus probably meant was, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these others around here love me?" Jesus is alluding to yet another of Peter's statements made right before the trial. You know that in the upper room, where when Jesus said to Peter that you're going to deny me three times before the night is over, and Peter responded, the effect of, "Even if all the others leave you, I will not," implying that, "No, I love you more than all these love you." And so Jesus gets to the first issue, Simon's pride that he had prior to the trial, the crucifixion, and resurrection. Peter answers, he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." But Peter doesn't go any further than that. He just says, "You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, to Peter, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Notice that Jesus no longer adds the "more than these" phrase. Well, that part's been taken care of. And so Peter replies, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Then he said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Way back in John chapter 2, towards the end of that chapter, there was a little bit of Jesus saying, John saying, Jesus knew what was in the heart of men. He would not trust himself to them. And that whole idea of knowing everything, once again, it comes back into this little vignette, this little scene here, this little conversation. Peter gets it now. Jesus knows everything. Jesus knows what's in people's hearts. And so, as Jesus says, feed my sheep. And then Jesus continues, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. And this he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had been reclining at the table close to him and had said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? When Peter saw John, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? So, this chapter there, I think it describes a little bit of the uncertainties that were facing the disciples. What were they supposed to do? Were they supposed to go back to their jobs? Where was Jesus in all this? Because this was only the third time that Jesus showed himself to them. So in the weeks that had passed now since the resurrection, up to this point, they'd only seen Jesus twice. Now their future seemed a little uncertain. Their livelihood, perhaps, was uncertain. They didn't have a leader. That's right. Yeah, did Jesus look different in that they didn't recognize him? I suppose speculation is that he must have looked different in some way that they didn't recognize him, purely through physical means. It was only when Jesus spoke, behaved, and acted in ways that resembled Jesus prior to the crucifixion death that the disciples recognized him. And I think that's an important point, because when Jesus, as I spoke last week, I think we'll recognize Jesus not for the signs that he does, but for the character that he is. We recognize Jesus for who he is. Not because he matches some sort of physical description or he performs miracles. It's interesting that Peter is the one that finally gets up and begins to lead. And, you know, I think Jesus sort of does affirm that gift of leadership here that Peter does have in giving Peter the responsibility, the first responsibility to feed and to tend and to feed again the flock, the lambs and the sheep. But then when Peter begins to meddle with someone else's future, it's a little rebuke. Yeah. Jesus says, don't worry about what's going to happen to someone else. You know, just be certain. Just follow me. And everything else will fall into place. In this story, we see once again Jesus providing and Jesus caring for the disciples. And his promise to provide, his promise to care, continues. Not only that, but Jesus commissions his disciples, through Peter, to provide and care for God's flock and God's family. And so, well, as subsequent generations of Christians follow after Peter, follow after the apostles, the commission remains the same. You know, Jesus' commission to feed lambs, to tend sheep, continues with us today. And Jesus' command to Peter to follow him continues today. This chapter, I think, is provided to show us that whatever happens, God remains faithful and God continues to provide. God continues to provide his children with everything that is necessary. And once again, we're not going to get everything we want. In fact, I'm pretty sure we don't want to get everything we want. But God knows what we need. And God will provide all that we need. So what does it mean to follow Christ? What does it mean to love Christ? What does it mean to have communion and to abide with Christ? These are questions that this chapter, I think, provides answers to. I think it all comes down to providing and caring for one another. The middle of this chapter is all about Jesus providing, and then Jesus delegating that responsibility to provide to his disciples. So I suppose, as I believe, John 21 is the very last thing written in the New Testament. And I think John must have felt that was the key to Christianity, the key to being a disciple of Christ. That is to love, to provide, and to care for one another. And so if any of us are unsure of where to go or what to do next, I'm pretty sure we won't go wrong in continuing to provide and to care for one another and for our neighbors. We probably won't go wrong in bringing healing and bringing hope to someone. And I think for John, this was the good news, the gospel that Jesus preached and demonstrated. And so to follow Christ, then, is to become a selfless giver in order to meet the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual needs that this world has. In this community, among us right here, we're to meet one another's physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. As long as we are abiding in Christ, we receive all that we need in order to meet all that we are asked to give to the world. So I can imagine John thinking about what else could he write, and looking back through all of Jesus' life, and the one thing, perhaps the only thing, that really sticks, that rises to the surface of his mind, is Jesus' selfless giving love. And how throughout his life, that was what Jesus was trying to teach his disciples. To be like that. To be like that. And so John closes his gospel account for the final time. In the last two verses, did John write them, or did his scribes write them? I have a feeling that it was his scribes that wrote these few little notes down at the bottom. As John, tired from perhaps relating this for the one final time, sinks back into his chair, or perhaps lies back down, the scribes continue writing, "This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things, and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true." And as these scribes think about all that John has spoken to them about Jesus, they continue, "Now there are also many other things that Jesus did, were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." Jesus cannot be placed in a box. Jesus cannot be placed in a library. Because Jesus continues to live. Jesus continues to live through the Holy Spirit, who is at work today, who is at work in us today, so that through us, Jesus' mission of self-sacrificing, self-giving, love and care and provision for the world will continue. So I guess my challenge for all of us is to live that kind of life. The kind of life that John described, Jesus lived in his gospel account.